Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to K-Drama Chat. Don't forget to subscribe to the show, leave a 5-star rating, post a review in your favorite podcast site, and comment on each episode on our website, kdramachat.com. And if you like this podcast, please share it with your friends.
Listeners, we just wrapped up season 12, where we recapped and analyzed Extraordinary Attorney Woo. We had an amazing 16 weeks of talking about legal cases, autism spectrum disorder, Nunchi, character arcs, and legal dilemmas. Before we dive into season 13, we are doing several special episodes. Today, we have the pleasure and honor of having Ellen Sullivan on the show.
Ellen Sullivan is a longtime listener. She posts thoughtful comments on the blog. Sung-hee and I met her during our K-Drama Chat meet and greet a couple of months ago, and she's become a friend. Ellen is also a screenwriter, and she offered to have a conversation with us about the art and science of screenwriting, the winning formulas, and why some K-dramas have been smash hits while others have fallen flat.
Well, we're so lucky that Ellen was able to squeeze us in before her upcoming trip to Korea. Ellen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you guys so much for having me, Joanna and Sung-hee, and I know I speak for everyone out there that we're so grateful to the two of you for all the effort and time and skill and humor and all of that stuff that you put into this, because we all appreciate it so much. You give so much to this effort, and we're just glad to be here, and I am so honored to be on your show.
Ellen, what a pleasure to have you here, and thank you for your words. You know, Sung-hee and I sometimes will say, we're just two college buddies doing a podcast. And then we hear from our listeners, and we're so grateful. Hey, before we begin our discussion, listeners, this episode will be nothing but spoilers about the following shows: Crash Landing on You, Mr. Queen, Mr. Sunshine, When the Phone Rings, and Captivating the King. And by the way, if you haven't watched these shows, we covered Mr. Sunshine in season 4, Mr. Queen in season 5, and Crash Landing on You in season 8. We also covered When the Phone Rings in episode 10.13 at the end of season 10. So lots of spoilers. If you haven't watched those 5 shows, maybe stop right now and watch those shows. But if you have watched, or if you don't care about spoilers, you are good to go. So Ellen, let's start with your background. You came to us and you said, you know, I have a lot to say about the screenwriting of these Korean dramas. So tell us about your background and how you got started and why you've got such expertise in this area.
Well, my family moved to California when I was 3 because my grandfather was out here. And since the 1920s, when he and my grandmother split up, he had been working for the director John Ford. I don't know if you've ever heard of him.
Yes.
But he was hired as a double for John Wayne and Victor McLaughlin and Joel McRae, those 3 actors, because he was 6'4". And his name was Brick Sullivan. The Brick part was because he had bright red hair and he was a big guy and a build. He could also ride a horse and he did all kinds of stunt work, and he was on a million TV shows. His most famous role was in the movie Singing in the Rain. And in the Singing in the Rain dance sequence with Gene Kelly, he's splashing around on the sidewalk and everything. And he finally, at the end, looks up and there's this huge policeman standing there with his arms crossed, looking down. And that was my grandpa.
Wow.
Wow. We'll have to check out that scene on YouTube.
If you look him up on IMDb, he was in From Here to Eternity. He was in It's a Wonderful Life. He was in all these other Academy Award-winning movies. And then in TV shows after that, including a lot of Westerns. And so we were on movie sets and TV sets as kids a lot. And because we lived in the San Fernando Valley in North Hollywood and Burbank, we were surrounded by people whose parents all worked in those industries too. As a child, I was so fascinated. It looked to me like the actors' jobs were boring because they sat around in chairs all the time waiting for all of the lighting people and the camera people and the set directors and all that to do their stuff. And everybody else was like busy bees around them getting all of this going. And I thought all of that behind the camera stuff looked way more interesting.
Oh.
And to me, the magic, and this was as a child, was how fake it all looked from the set standpoint and how real it looked on screen and on television. That was what got me interested in writing in the first place. Then when I was in the third grade, we came back after summer break and they asked all of us to write our paragraphs about how we spent our summer vacation. So I sat down with my number two pencil and my lined pad and wrote up, you know, spent about 15 minutes writing three or four paragraphs. And so did my classmates, but I was done ahead of everybody else. And they were spending all this time erasing and scratching out and starting over. And I didn't. I just threw it down there on the paper. And then I thought, ooh, I should have spent more time on this. And so we all turned it in and I was worried all night long because she was going to give them back to us the next day. And I thought, geez, I should have spent more time. So we walk into class the next day and she said, Ellen wrote the A paragraphs and these are the best examples. You should all learn from her how to do this properly. And I thought, huh? You know, and I felt like I had cheated. And I went up to the teacher afterwards and I said, I feel bad. And she said, you're a good writer. You should do this for a living when you grow up. And I went, oh. So that was the focus from then on. And then I went to the University of Hawaii and went to journalism school, majored in journalism. And over the course of time, I eventually moved back to California and became a technical writer. But then I took classes in screenwriting at UCLA and here in Orange County. And I had a screenwriter boyfriend who eventually got a movie produced. And his younger brother, and they're all still friends, is Shane Black, who's a very successful writer and director. He currently has a show. He wrote The Lethal Weapon. That was his origin of his career. And he wrote and directed Iron Man 3.
Oh, wow.
And his latest effort is an Amazon movie called Play Dirty, which just came out a few weeks ago. In addition to all that, I had a screenwriting workshop at my home for 10 years, which had working screenwriters in it. On my own screenwriting, I've currently resurrected a children's time travel script that I had done several years ago, and I'm updating it. At the time, I had an agent. So I haven't had anything actually produced, but I've had an agent and a lot of years critiquing other people's work with movies. And so I can deconstruct and analyze them with the best of them. And that's how I came to this, because especially with you guys, when I heard your first podcast and you started talking about the midpoint, and I thought, oh, these people know stuff. But then I gradually realized, because of the way that you talk about things, that you hadn't actually formally studied screenwriting. You were just really perceptive. So I thought I could add a little something about understanding how it's done, why things work and why they don't work, and help everybody's enjoyment a little bit more.
Sung-hee, I think to say that we haven't studied screenwriting is like the biggest understatement of the year.
Oh, I'm complete novice and amateur in that area. But Ellen, so tell us how you got introduced to K-dramas and then how you found our podcast.
My friend, dear friend, Brian Humphrey, had touted me on them for a couple of years, and I just hadn't gotten around to it. And eventually I watched the show My Mister, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. And then I called him up and told him that My Mister was magnificent. And thank you. Can I cook you some dinner? You know, what can I do to pay you back? And he said, I've never watched that show. And I said, what are you talking about? You're the one that told me about it. And he said, no, I told you about a show called Mr. Sunshine.
Oh. It's one of the misters.
It was one of the misters. And so that had stuck in my brain for 2 years. And that's what I had remembered anyway. So I then watched Mr. Sunshine.
Another masterpiece.
Another masterpiece. And fell in love with that. And I was off to the races after that. And he also recommended Crash Landing on You. So I went to that. And then Mr. Queen was thanks to you.
Thanks to Sung-hee.
Yeah. And Sung-hee, just her mentioning of it in conversation about it, and then the fact that you'd already covered it on the podcast, I watched that. And Brian, he wasn't as comfortable. He watched the whole thing, but he wasn't as comfortable with Mr. Queen because he's a guy. And the thought of inhabiting a woman's body was too weird for him, whereas I thought it was very entertaining. Anyway, so that was how I got going. And I listened to your podcast for a year before I ever even commented. So for all of you out there that have been shy about commenting, I completely understand. But once you get into it, you almost can't shut yourself up.
Absolutely. Come on down. You know, we want to hear everyone's voice. And Ellen, you certainly contribute a lot to the blog. All right, well, let's start at the beginning. You say that there's a formula to Western dramas. And, you know, again, we don't have a background in screenwriting, but during season 9, when we discussed Kingdom, we did talk about the hero's journey and how Prince Yi Chang's journey was a true hero's journey. And of course, it's a wonderful story with zombies. So maybe give us a brief overview of, I guess, the history of Western drama and how they're structured.
Well, first of all, I'll address your comment about The Hero's Journey, which was based on a book by Joseph Campbell.
Yes.
And Joseph Campbell talks about the story progression of who we think are heroes, how they are called to action. Typically, in any drama, the reluctant hero is a typical trope.
Yes.
Where someone is suddenly put in a position where they have to rise to the occasion, and at first they doubt themselves or doubt their interest, or and then they think, oh, hell, I've got to go fight this fight, and off they go. So it's a fascinating book, and I recommend that book to anyone who wants to read about drama. There was a screenwriting teacher named Sid Field who became sort of the guru of Western screenplays, and he attributes all of this, and most drama schools do in both the U.S. and South Korea, to Aristotle, who was the first one to analyze the Greek plays in 500 BC. When I was looking into the connections between Western and Eastern drama, I wanted to know when Chinese people first knew that there were Greek people and vice versa. And I was astonished to find that trade between the Far East and Greece went all the way back to 500 BC itself.
Oh, interesting.
So back in Aristotle's time, they knew China was there.
Hmm.
And China knew that Greece was there because they were traveling across the what became the Silk Road route all the way across those continents. They couldn't sail there yet.
Right.
But isn't that interesting that they were aware of each other? Anyway, Aristotle talked about the three-act structure, and that's what we still have today. And it's the beginning, middle, and end. It's the setup, the conflict, and then the resolution.
So would you say that Korean dramas are structured the same way? And if not, how are they structured?
They're similar, but they're based on a concept called Gisung-jun-gyu. I'm sure I'm not pronouncing that right, but it's a four-part structure. And that was based on Chinese poetry. There are Chinese words for those same terms. And it differs from the Western structure in that it has more of an emphasis on character development. It's longer, so it's not used as much for movies. And the conclusion is not always a resolution to all of the issues raised. It sometimes leaves things in an ambiguous state, as in life, because not everything is neatly wrapped up with a bow. In Korean dramas that are movies, they usually do follow the three-act structure. But in the serialized K-dramas that we watch, they tend more towards the Asian model. But what they have in common, to me, the midpoint is the fascinating thing. The midpoint is the paramount thing in both structures. And it's a huge deal to have the midpoint happen exactly in the middle of the story. And no one has successfully been able to persuade me that they know why that is. It's just wrong if it's done wrong, and it's right if it's right. And we all feel uncomfortable if you do it badly. That's for the point where the plot thickens. And that is universal across Eastern and Western drama. So there are variables. And I think that the Eastern, the Chinese-Korean model, works better for these long shows, for something that's going to be 10, 12, 16, 20 episodes.
Ellen, have you seen any of the Chinese dramas? Because they will have 50 episodes.
I know. They're daunting because they take a single story and stretch it out that far. So I can't say that I've actually watched a whole one. What do you think about that?
I haven't watched one with 50 episodes. I've watched like 16 episode Chinese dramas. And then actually I have another question. So if you take like an American series, like a Grey's Anatomy, for example, how long has it been going? Like 22 seasons or something like that. So what's their framework? Is it a single season that has the setup?
Well, here's the way it works in a series like Grey's Anatomy. They take an episodic standpoint where there is an underlying story that's a long thread through the whole thing. In Grey's Anatomy, it was a romance. But each episode is a story within itself with a beginning, middle, and end. And that's what's different, because with the K-dramas, they're not episodic. They all pull the whole story along episode by episode. And there are smaller stories within that, but they're not necessarily all wrapped up in an episode. I would say Extraordinary Attorney Wu is more Western style because it goes case by case by case.
Right.
So there are many similarities. Another example that I like is the movie Parasite, the one that won the Best Picture, which I hope you do an episode on one of these days.
Yeah, we've considered it, actually.
But Parasite is a classic Western three-act structure. As crazy as the plot in the movie is, it's a real by-the-book movie, which is why it won Best Picture, because all of the educated minds that vote on the Academy Awards, they recognized that. They went, oh, that's like an Alfred Hitchcock movie. And they recognized that Alfred Hitchcock was the inspiration behind it. The director took what he knew from the examples. And they use Alfred Hitchcock in South Korean film classes because he explained a lot about why he did what he did, for one thing. But they use his movies as examples for suspense and for keeping the action going.
Well, I have a couple of comments on this. So Sung-hee and I have definitely talked about the pivotal episode 8. And we've also talked about how Korean dramas seem to spend more time on character development than Western shows. I mean, like,
yes,
you know the backstory, you know their emotions, you know how they're going to react in certain situations. And for sure, we've talked about how we don't always have a happy ending, which, you know, like sometimes if I'm starting a show, I'll actually text my cousin Linda and I'll say, okay, is this going to be a K-drama? Because I'm not in the mood for a K-drama. Like when I was watching Bon Appetit, I had to know, is this a K-drama or a K-trauma? And of course, I'm not going to give it away, but it was a legit question in my mind because I've been so traumatized by some shows where like for months afterwards, I couldn't go back to the show because it was so sad.
Right. I think there was more of a trend before, but it seems to me that the shows that have been coming out more recently have leaned more towards a happy ending. And I'm wondering if it's because now they're appealing to a more global audience.
Ah, the Netflix effect that we've talked about.
Right. Exactly. If the audience is not just South Korea, who's used to kind of a more Asian structure where maybe things don't get resolved at the end and everything doesn't get wrapped up in a nice bow. But if you're appealing to the world and the world wants a happy ending, I feel like that's kind of where things have gone. But in any case, Ellen, so let's put your framework to the test. Could you tell us about how these writers start what you call the setup? And let's take one of our all-time favorite shows, Crash Landing on You. So what would you say the setup is for that?
Well, In Seoul, South Korea, Yoon Suri is a haughty, beautiful, and seemingly cold entrepreneur from a Chaebol family. We see that she's estranged from her family and why. And if you notice, when she eventually goes to her family's house for dinner, and before she actually arrives, we learn all kinds of stuff, that she's the illegitimate daughter, that she was shunned in great part by the family. Her eldest brother blows up at the rest of the family about why she's not there. He kind of sticks up for her a little bit. And then she shows up and soon leaves, but not before her father confers the chairmanship on her after his embezzlement scandal. Anyway, so we learn all that stuff about her being an entrepreneur and starting her own company and being very successful. And then in North Korea, we meet Captain Ri, and he and his guys are on duty at the DMZ, and they're patrolling, and they find thieves that are robbing historical sites that are within that boundary and excavating artifacts that they intend to sell for a lot of money. And a group of South Korean soldiers caught the same guys at the same time. So there's a confrontation, and Captain Ri says, no, I'm going to make sure these guys are punished. Don't you guys worry. Leave us alone. And everybody backs off. And he takes them, the prisoners, and takes them back to the security forces. And we learn that the Korean security forces are up to no good. And that is very important in the story. So then Suri is filming a paragliding commercial for her sportswear line. And all of a sudden, this freak tornado comes up out of nowhere and dumps her into North Korea. And she isn't even aware that she's actually there at first. And she falls out of a tree into Captain Ri's arms, handsome Captain Ri. Then she tries to run away, and he lets her go, pretty much. But she gets lost, and she winds up in front of his house in the village that's closest to the borderline, and he sees her standing in front of the house, and the security forces are doing a sweep through the town, and he's worried for her, so he grabs her and pulls her into the gate to try to protect her. He knows those guys are not to be trusted, and that's the setup. That's the plot point one. These two people have met, and he's protective of her. So that's the setup for Crash Landing on You.
So Ellen, with the setup, we've met the main characters, we've seen their normal lives and their attitudes. What do you think the midpoint of the show is, and why that point?
In my opinion, the midpoint of the show happens over the course of episode 8. Actually, it happens at the end of episode 8. And at that point, Suri is kidnapped, and we don't know who she's been kidnapped by, and Captain Ri is frantically worried about her, and he's running around like a maniac trying to contact her, and things look really dark, and then he gets arrested. So things go bad, but over the course of episode 9, a whole bunch of events ensue, and episode 9 closes with Suri walking back across the North Korea-South Korea border, and we know she's now gone back to South Korea. So that turns the whole show around. And now she's back in her own country, and Captain Ri is on the other side, and we know that the story is going to have to shift to South Korea, which it does. So everything changes between the end of episode 8 and the end of episode 9. So to me, that's the midpoint.
Well, that literally is the midpoint of the show, between 8 and 9. And we on the podcast talk about the pivotal episode 8 all the time. And I think episode 8 is really interesting because Captain Ri makes the important decision to save Yoon Suri without regard for himself. And he's made this decision to go all in for Yoon Suri. So let's talk about the conclusion then.
Well, stop listening right here if you haven't seen the show, because it's a wonderful show, and then just come back after you've watched it. But they wind up meeting once a year in Switzerland, and not living happily ever after in this case. I think it's a real hybrid between the Eastern and Western concepts. But it wouldn't have been realistic if she had gone and lived in North Korea, or if he had abandoned his parents in North Korea and left them to the mercy of the North Korean authorities to live with her in South Korea, never to see his family again. We know all through the show that that's not going to happen. That can't be the way things turn out. So they find a way to wrap things up. One note on a character arc, if you remember, her older brother stuck up for her during the initial dinner with the family, saying that she hadn't been treated well. And that was really the only glimpse we got of him being a good guy. But it turned out that Suri persuaded him to sponsor a music competition in Switzerland every year, knowing that one of these days, maybe Captain Ri might be able to get himself there. And so he eventually does, because he's now become the national pianist for the national orchestra. And they managed to have an idyllic couple of weeks every year in Switzerland, where they had initially met, and it's neutral. So it just wrapped it up beautifully, because we love them being together so much. And we couldn't figure out a way in our minds the whole show, how in the world is this ever going to work out? We're so sad. So that when they're reunited, it's just joyful. And we think it's okay.
Well, I think it rings true because it makes a lot of sense. It's a realistic conclusion.
Yes.
You know, I think for the East Asian audience too, it was a retelling of the folk tale about the goat herder and the weaver, the ones that can meet once a year on the seventh day of the seventh month. And they get to see each other only once a year, and that's their happy time, and the rest of the year they can't be together. So, you know, it's a Chinese folktale, a Japanese folktale, and a Korean folktale.
Well, that's very poetic.
So the East Asian audiences understood it and accepted it, but maybe us Americans are like, wait, is this really a happy ending?
It was a happy ending for me, even though I like happy endings, because it was a satisfying ending. It wasn't unrealistic. So often in an attempt to have a happy ending, they wrap things up where it's just silly.
Hey, so let's talk about Mr. Queen, Sung-hee's favorite. What's the setup there?
Oh my gosh. Talk about a fantastic setup. So I wrote, starts with a confusing bang, but we're not bored while we get it sorted out. Present day chef's soul is transferred to a suicidal Joseon queen, while he lays in a coma from a fall from a high floor into a pool. He awakens in her body, though her soul is still there in the background. I'm still so impressed with how they did this.
It is such an incredible setup. I love the first episode when we're introduced to all the characters and the strange but wonderful premise of the story. So what would you say the midpoint is then? It must be in episode 10 or 11, since the show has 20 episodes.
Okay, I wrote, less pronounced, but a transition period shifts them from suspicion of each other to alliance with each other. And that's the turning point we needed, where they stop detesting each other, they start being interested in each other. And this all happens relatively rapidly in the middle of the show. And I think the crucial point was when she fixed up the banquet so that it was not a failure. And he realizes that she engineered that behind the scenes. And that's when the whole energy changes.
Well, you know, I think this transition is what made the show not just good, but really great. Because I think that's when it moves past the initial comedy of the setup to real purpose. And when they get to that point where the king is willing to save the country and they're willing to save each other at personal cost to themselves.
Yeah, it's also kind of interesting because at that point, you start to see the chef from the present day start to recede and the queen starts to show up. So again, it also kind of changes how they're seeing each other.
I agree. And so it accomplishes all of the usual midpoint goals,
yeah,
which is changing the direction of the show.
Well, talk to us about the conclusion, because this conclusion is amazing.
I think the conclusion in some ways was the most impressive and beautiful of all of our three examples. And that's because the character of the king, the character of the real queen, who had been lying dormant there, but watching and listening through the beginning of the show, and the chef, who was transported back into her body, they all dramatically changed each other. They were different people, all three of them, by the end of the show. So at the end of the show, when he wakes back up in what was the future, but he's now back in his body, and he goes and checks the history, it turns out that everything is different. And the king actually managed to initiate democracy. And the queen, going back to that time, she's happy now. She's learned that she has authority, and she learned she can fight for what she believes in and succeed. And the king, that's sort of the most poignant thing. He loves her. He appreciates her. She's the little girl that saved him from the well. But he kind of misses that guy, his buddy.
Right. The irreverent queen.
The irreverent queen, yeah. And he expresses that. So it's just beautiful. It's just wonderful.
Yeah, I agree with you that the transformation of all these central characters was really moving and really touching and really inspiring. Well, let's move on to Mr. Sunshine, which we discussed in season 3 of K-Drama Chat.
Well, let me read what I had written about the setup. We meet all the characters in childhood in the first 2 episodes, and it's a 24-episode show. So we spread the setup over the first 2 episodes at least, which is proportional to how it should be. Choi Yu-jin, the son of slaves, saw his parents slaughtered by an evil rich family. He escapes and is adopted and brought to the U.S. by a kind missionary. He's renamed Eugene Choi and joins the post-Civil War army, eventually transitioning to Joseon. Go Ae-shin is orphaned and brought as a baby to the home of her noble grandfather. Her parents were activists for Korean independence, and they were murdered shortly after her birth. She is smuggled to Joseon. She is demure and traditional on the surface, but she burns with zeal for the cause that her parents died for. We see that right away. As for momentum, our two main characters meet on a rooftop, masked, at night, trying to assassinate the same target. So it really starts off with a bang, with everything we need to get the story going.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Mr. Sunshine opened so well. You know, Sung-hee and I have talked about how with some of these shows, it takes a couple episodes to get going, but Mr. Sunshine from the very beginning was compelling. Now, the show has 24 episodes, so was the midpoint at the 12 or 13 episode mark?
There is some controversy about this among Korean film critics, which I found out from ChatGPT. In my own opinion, contrary to ChatGPT, I think it's when Eugene's dad, adopted dad, Joseph, is murdered, because it just changes his perspective on everything. He finds out that Joseph was motivated by a desire for Korean independence himself and had been in alliance with the king to try to keep things on track. And he's horrified that he was murdered and he's angry. So to me, that's the midpoint where his focus shifts. Instead of just being in love with her, he's starting to feel that same pull towards standing up for what's right. So there's a little controversy about that, and it does happen over a couple of episodes. But the upshot is that everybody, all the main characters' focus shifts to Korean independence.
Right. I agree with that, because I think, like in Mr. Queen, I think there's a transition point where the characters start to think about goals that are beyond their own immediate concerns. They start to think beyond themselves. So what would you say about the conclusion then for Mr. Sunshine?
I've watched the episode about the last episode about 12 times. And I thought, you know, maybe one of these days I'll get desensitized enough so I don't burst into tears. But every time I do, all of the guys and all of her associates within the rebel groups end up dying.
Right.
It's very sad. And at the very end, she is still in there fighting for the cause of Korean independence. The deaths of all of these men and her loyal servants, everybody, enabled her to do that, to keep fighting. They died so that she could keep fighting. And they thought that her life was more important than their own. Says me getting choked up all over again.
Well, you know me and the OST, and my favorite song from Mr. Sunshine is Like a Beautiful Flame. And she talked about how she wanted to burn brightly for Joseon, even if it meant that she would be extinguished. And in the end, all four of them experienced that, right?
Yes.
That somehow they were able to burn brightly. She's the only one who didn't get extinguished in the end. So their sacrifice was amazing.
Right. I feel exactly the same way about the end of the show, when all the men died in the service of Korean independence and inspired by Goeshin. And I think when you see those three male characters, they all orbited Goeshin, Eugene Choi, Gu Dong-mae, and Kim Hee-sung. But it was interesting because when you look at their story arcs, they all started as self-centered, involved in their own concerns. And then you see their transition, inspired by their love for her, and then their conclusion where they sacrifice themselves for the greater good of Joseon. And in doing so, I thought that's when they fulfilled the greatest and most noble part of themselves.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, so here's the $64 million question for you, Ellen. These three dramas that we've just recapped and mapped in terms of the drama framework, they were all great. They worked. We love the characters. We love the show. But there are many, many shows that try to follow the formula and they don't work. So what made these shows work? Why do we love them so much?
There are a number of things that we're about to discuss that make them work or not work. And these are fundamental principles of screenwriting. One of the things that you might hear me talk about is exposition. Are you familiar with that term, you guys?
No.
Nope.
Exposition is when something has to be explained to the audience, and there has to be some vehicle to do that. The quirky best friend, for instance, is a vehicle for exposition because it gives the main character someone to talk to and explain something to. And this is both Korean and Western drama. That character or series of characters, usually they are doing something while they're talking, if they have to talk. The first principle is show it, don't tell it, if you possibly can. But that can't always be avoided. So you have to have someone to tell things to and for them to comment back. So that has to be handled very carefully. And even in the worst K-dramas, they do a pretty good job in that respect. Otherwise, you end up with a sentence like, "Grandfather, you have raised me all this time since my parents were killed in the tragic but mysterious train accident 10 years ago. Why did you not examine that?" You know, and if you have to listen to something like that, you're thinking, geez, couldn't they have figured out a more less clunky way to do that?
Right, because you have to spell it out.
Exactly. So a skillful drama in all areas will try to avoid that scenario where something clunks like that. I don't know a better word than clunk to use. The next thing is the development of character within the character themselves.
So the character arcs?
The character arcs. I'll read you some of the examples I wrote down. In Crash Landing, I'm picking two character arcs, Captain Ree and Sodan. Captain Ree is very noble, and he's just an all-around good, upright, honest, straightforward guy. In fact, I've always kind of thought that Hyun Bin is probably kind of like that in real life. He's so good at it. Kind of a stiff, you know, at times. But anyway, he has this childish side where he gets pouty and snippy at funny times, like when Ciri tries to cut him off from all the video games.
Hmm.
And he tells her she's being mean. And she said, no, I'm not. You're acting like a baby. And he says, I am not. And I think it's so cute. And then with Sodan, and this is more tragic, she starts out as this tough cookie. Her fiance has abandoned her and she's mad at everybody. But eventually she learns through Alberto Gu, the character that loves her, that she's kind of got it all wrong. She's learned what real love is from him. And so at the very end, she gives Captain Ree back his camera that has the picture from Switzerland of Ciri. And she realizes what real love is and that she had real love. And she will always have that love, even though her lover is gone.
There are so many character arcs in Crash Landing. I think that Captain Ree's arc is less about his personality changing and maybe the fact that he saved himself. Because remember, he was this person who felt like he wasn't worthy of happiness to someone who was going to save Ciri and who eventually came to accept that he could be happy. So I think that was the important part of his story. With Ciri herself, man, she went through quite the transformation because she went from being this haughty, driven, indifferent, almost cruel CEO to being a kind, compassionate, and joyful CEO who ended up reconciling with the mother or the stepmother, who ended up sort of reconciling with the older brother and using the older brother for good, to herself finding her own happy ending, even if it's not completely happy by other people's definitions. So I felt like her story arc was just amazing and dramatic.
Well, she learned that it wasn't all about her.
Right.
She learned that she couldn't just live on her own and not need other people. She realized that other people were important and they were important to help her and she was in a position to help them. And I think that's what led her to this realization and the happiness that came with it.
And Sunghee, what's interesting about Ciri's transformation is, yes, of course, Captain Ree loved her, but it was his soldiers and the insurance agent and her assistant who showed the most loyalty and I think changed her attitude about like the little people.
Well, also the village women.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, you're right.
Who are all such wonderful friends and so supportive of her. She really learned what it was to have friends.
Yeah.
And I think that was really eye-opening for her. So let's talk about Gu Sung-jun, because I love this character in Crash Landing.
Yeah.
Because I think he's introduced first as this really self-serving con artist. But of course, we get to be much more sympathetic when we learn that he's actually motivated by revenge after his family was ruined by Yoon Se-ri's powerful family. And then over the course of the story, he shows himself to be really caring and loving, and to the point where he's able to bring that the cold and haughty Sodan out of her shell. And then he ultimately sacrifices himself for her. And I was wondering if this is a paradigm for redemption arcs, that the self-serving character ends up sacrificing themselves to the greater good.
Hmm.
Well, let's turn to Mr. Queen. So what were your favorite character arcs?
I'm picking the king himself, and I'm picking Jo Hwa-jin. And she, if you remember, was the concubine that he loved and who loved him. And they don't end up together. Anyway, so the king starts off as, we think, he's kind of a boob. You know, he's
right.
Stupid. He can't read. He seems overly interested in the opposite sex.
Right.
And he looks at pictures all the time instead of spending time learning what he should as king. We eventually learn, though, that he is on the side of the underdogs and the peasants in the country, and that at night he trains and pursues everything he can. He wants to change the whole arc of history. I don't want to go too long about this, but I read up on the real history of this king, and I see why he was the inspiration, because he intended to do good. He actually did try.
Yes, that's true.
And the Andong Kims were the ones that ended up writing the history of this time. So he may have been a much better king than history reported. And he also may have been assassinated by them. So I can see why the writer decided to pick this king to do this with. Anyway, so she transforms him and vice versa, and they become allied, and he finds the courage through his love for her and his own wanting to do the right thing to triumph. And so that's his character arc. With Jowa Jin, she is passed over as queen at first because she belongs to the wrong family, and she's hoping to be like the number one consort, but that isn't looking too good either, again, because of her family status and being manipulated. So she's trying to engineer things and deceive people in order to get what she wants, which is the king. But through interaction with the queen, she realizes that she's sacrificed her self-respect to do this. And she starts to admire the queen's character and determination. And she ends up resolving to be a better person. And one of my favorite scenes is when she learns that the king is still alive. And then she just does everything she can and takes great risks to support both the queen and the king. So she goes through a real turnaround during the course of the show. And it's all earned. It's all real in believability.
Well, you know, for me, it was Zhang Bonghuan, because he was the playboy chef who used women, didn't care about others, was proud and haughty. But by the end of the show, he's made the king love the queen. He puts that evil chief of staff behind bars, and maybe, just maybe, he's not the playboy who uses women that he once was.
Yeah, I really agree that he had the greatest transformation. But I also think there is an unspoken kind of mirror image of that transformation with Kim So-young, who was the depressed queen whose body he's inhabiting. Remember, she's the one who actually tried to kill herself, and that's when they had that body switch. And by sharing her existence with Zhang Bonghuan, I think she's gained a sense of agency. And the new historical record at the end of the story shows that she ruled the country with her husband, King Chuljong, with great wisdom.
Yeah.
So we don't really talk about her so much, but I think she also had quite the transformation. Well, let's turn to Mr. Sunshine.
Well, I don't want to go into too much detail because I think all five of the major characters go through very, very interesting arcs.
Yes.
So I'm just going to focus on the shallow playboy, Kim Hoo-sung, who was engaged to A-shin, and he comes back from Japan, and he's been kind of a useless, rich, good-for-nothing all this time. And he finds a purpose to start a newspaper that prints the truth, because there's Japanese propaganda all over Seoul and the country. And he considers it his mission to get that word out there, and he's got the money and the skill to do it. So he takes that on as his way of helping Joseon independence, and he ends up dying for it too.
Yeah. Well, you know, Go Ae-shin is my favorite character arc. She's born to a wealthy family, but she wants more. She's got good intentions, but at the very beginning, she's still a spoiled, untrained noble who puts in the work to become a trusted member of the resistance, and she puts herself in danger for the country. She actually falls in love with Captain Choi. She has her world turned upside down when he turns out to be a former slave, but she gets over it and allies herself with him to fight for Joseon. So she had an amazing arc.
Well, I loved the character of Gu Dong-mei. I mean, he started off as a slave. I mean, not even a slave, a butcher, like almost like an untouchable. And then he becomes this powerful, basically gangster. And so I thought there was a very strong parallel between him and Eugene Choi, in that they were both from the lowest rejected level of society, but then rose to positions of power by going outside of traditional Joseon society. And in spite of initially rejecting Joseon, both of them came back to be inspired to not only fight for their country, but then ultimately to die for it.
Yeah. So Ellen, here's our question to you. Why do these arcs work? Because there's lots and lots of K-dramas with really great characters. Why do these work?
I think these work because of setups and payoffs, which I'm going to explain in a minute. But we've already discussed how the village women and Captain Rhee's men show us who Ceree really is. She learns about herself. As you said, she gains friends. So in Mr. Queen, I think that your favorite character, the chef from the future, he learns a lot about why he's got a role to play in this pageant that he has fallen into, and that he naturally has a lot of guts. So he jumps in. He learns that so many of the people in the palace are good human beings that will help him if he trusts them. So he really turns the tide and turns into a different person over the course of the show. And we see that at the end. And in Mr. Sunshine, my favorite scenes are where the three guys are in the bar.
Yes.
And they are so annoyed with each other all the time. But you can see that they gradually start to admire each other, too, because they're all pretty heroic in their own ways. So they start to kind of work together, even though they keep teasing each other. So we learn so much about each of those three during those scenes. Plus, they're funny. That's why I think that these three dramas are so good, because they use character interaction to show who people are and to bring their character arcs along, so it doesn't seem contrived.
So it's in their interactions with others that we really see the authenticity of those characters. Now, Ellen, you also say that character motivation has to be clear and believable. So talk to us about that.
Well, we naturally, as in our real lives, if we don't know why someone does what they do, you can use that as a plot device so that there's some suspense on that. But if you don't eventually explain why someone does what they do, the whole thing fails. When the phone rings, there's an example coming up of that in our discussion, but it just doesn't work.
So I think you're talking about the Big Song character and When the Phone Rings. And we wondered through the entire show why he was so mean to Hong Hee-ju. I mean, he loved her, but he was cruel and indifferent toward her. Why? We never even learn it, because that was never made clear, and we never could figure out like what his motivations were.
Yeah, I completely agree, because throughout the show, that made absolutely no sense to me at all. So what else made these shows work?
Well, the foreshadowing and payoffs is huge, and the timing of the foreshadowing and payoffs. If you leave too much time, I learned this again with Crash Landing on You, because when I went and rewatched the first episode, I wondered at first, at the end of the show, why we're so buying that one brother of Ceree's was so evil and the other one turned out to be not such a bad guy, kind of stupid, but not so bad. And that was because of that plant in the first episode where he sticks up to her at the dinner. And I had forgotten all about that. We went through 16 episodes of drama, so part of my mind remembered that. And that's why it was okay that he turned out to be the way he did. And so that's a beautiful classic example of successful foreshadowing and payoff. Even if you don't remember why something makes sense to you, it does. And if you go back and look in the story, it's there when it's done properly.
Right. It sounds like having that connection of foreshadowing followed by the payoff brings a cohesion to the storyline. And that just makes it so much more satisfying. But it seems to me that the trick would be to be skillful enough so you don't miss the foreshadowing clues, but then you don't get hit over the head with them. Because like with When the Phone Rings, we don't know why Baek-sun is so cruel to Hong Hee-ju. There's no foreshadowing or background to his motivations. And then later, he goes off to Argon. And that seemed to just come out of nowhere. I mean, why did he do this when he worked so hard to save her so many times? Now, it's funny because we actually now have an expression on the podcast. When a show goes off the rails and gets completely ridiculous, we say the show went off to Argon.
I'd like to say a couple of words about that. There is an expression called jumping the shark. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have.
Yes.
which stems from an episode of Happy Days when Fonzie jumped over a shark on water skis and everybody thought, well, they've gone too far now. The show's on the downhill.
Well, you know, that's really interesting because, Sunghee, you and I have said, let's rewatch the first episode. And then we're kind of hit over the head with, they said it all along. In Mr. Sunshine, in the very first episode, she's learning sad ending.
Yeah.
Right? Remember? And we're like, they told us all along there was going to be a sad ending. Versus in When the Phone Rings, there was no foreshadowing. We went back to the first couple episodes and we said, we cannot find his motivations.
Well, you don't have to remember the foreshadow.
Right.
But it has to register somewhere in your emotions that it's there.
Right. Then there's an emotional logic to the whole thing.
Yes.
Well, Ellen, let's turn to another important element, and that's the element that you call the MacGuffin.
That was Alfred Hitchcock's term for the statue that everyone wants in the Maltese Falcon in the early 40s. And it is the thing that everybody wants. And in his opinion, the thing, it really doesn't matter that much what it is. What matters is how badly everybody wants it and how far they're willing to go to get it. So it's the plot device of all time. Just as an example, in Mr. Sunshine, it's that letter with the money that King Gojong needs.
Right, the banknote.
To keep things going, yes. And all kinds of things happen because of that banknote.
Oh, that's really interesting. So it's the thing that everyone's looking for. Like in Crash Landing, it was the SD card, although nobody was really looking for it until the end when it was discovered. But speaking of Mr. Sunshine, Sunghee and I wondered why on earth the King of Joseon had a bank letter that would have ruined the country if it fell into the wrong hands. Like, what was the point of all of it?
Because the story needed a MacGuffin.
Right, there you go.
That's why it doesn't matter what it is.
Now, Ellen, what about humor? Because no matter how serious the K-drama, there are always humorous elements. And Sunghee and I have actually watched like Japanese and Chinese versions of the same drama that didn't have the same humorous elements. And sometimes in these shows, it feels almost like slapstick, and sometimes it's much more subtle, but it's always there in K-drama. So talk to us about humor.
The reason that it's there, in my opinion, and it's there in Western dramas, is to give everybody a break. The tension, it gives us time to breathe, to reflect. It has to serve a purpose. And you'll notice during the humorous episodes, there's always a reason. There's something we learn about the characters during the course of the humor. And my example for that are those bar scenes. Because those guys are teasing and clobbering each other, but they're also learning and reacting to each other. You probably each have your own examples, but I remember in Mr. Queen, when they're charging into the palace for their final battle, the royal chef is trying to be the big hero, and he's got his sword out there, and he's running ahead. And then he has a sneezing fit, which was hilarious. I just cracked up in the middle of it. And Korean drama so skillfully uses those breaks both to move the story forward, but also to let us relax a little bit before the tension builds back up again.
Comic relief, right?
That's why they say relief.
Well, I think no show did humor better than Mr. Queen. And even though I've seen this show countless times, I still laugh out loud when I see it. And I just recently rewatched the first episode. There's that scene where the queen leaps into what she thinks is the lake, and then she falls face first into the mud. And then she's walking around with mud all over her face. And then we have that first encounter with the king. It was just priceless. Now, the thing is that everything she does has complete internal logic. But they're so ludicrous for the situation, just turning everything upside down.
Well, in episode 3 of Mr. Queen, when the king goes to visit the queen and she burps in his face because she's been eating ramen, I couldn't get through the recap without laughing hysterically. Like, we had to pause the recording. Mr. Queen had some amazingly funny moments, but also many truly heartfelt ones. Like, remember when the king found the queen in the forest and she bursts into tears? So, Ellen, can we talk a little bit about how the best shows bring out our emotions? I mean, like, we still laugh out loud and we cry with these shows.
When you set up a script, if you're writing a script, We'll use Crash Landing on You as an example. You have the premise and you have where you want the story to end up, and you cannot construct a good drama with momentum if you don't know what's starting it and where it's going. It all falls apart if you don't get those things in advance. But the next thing you have to do is build your characters, and you have to write a whole biography of each one of them, whether you ever learn those things about them or not. You, the writer, need to know where they went to school, what kind of problems they had as children, what their basic viewpoint on life is, how they got that way, all that stuff. And when you put that depth of effort into developing the characters, they become real to the writer, I can say as a writer, but they become real to us, the audience, too. We start thinking of them as real people. And so their stories become real to us. And K-dramas do a magnificent job in this respect. With all of our three examples, that's partly why Min Woo doesn't get any love from the audience in Extraordinary Attorney Woo, because we don't care about him, do we? At all. We don't know why he's such a jerk or why he might become less of a jerk. We didn't get that depth in his particular case, whereas we did with everybody else.
Well, Ellen, you also say something really important, which is that with the best K-dramas, they trust the audience to figure things out themselves. What does this mean?
It means that you don't put anything that doesn't move the story forward or the character development forward at all. If you have a couple that's investigating a murder, they might be a police detective and his partner, and the victim wrote on a mirror in blood the name of, let's say, the Paradise Resort, and that's all they know about what might have happened to this victim. So they decide to go to the Paradise Resort and check things out, but they're going to have to go undercover, or they're not going to be able to learn anything. So the next thing we see after they've made this decision is a brief shot called an establishing shot of wheels landing at an airport. And then they're out at the pool with their sunglasses on and their phones turned on. And they're watching everything that's going on around them and making notes and observations with each other in disguise. And we don't get to see them going to the airport. We don't get to see them taking the taxi or checking into the hotel, getting their bathing suits on or any of that. And we don't need to see it. There's no reason for that. And everybody can figure all that out. We can just skip all that unnecessary stuff.
Right. That's right. Because you can just skip all that mundane stuff and just leave it to the viewer's imaginations.
Yeah.
But then sometimes they actually leave things out that actually add drama, like only showing you part of what's happening, like hinting at maybe a murder scene or that there's something going on in the bedroom, but you don't actually see what's going on inside.
Well, you know, that's really interesting because in Crash Landing, we know that Seri came back to South Korea and we don't see all the things that probably happened to her, like getting picked up by the military, getting whisked home, going to the hospital and getting interrogated. All we see is that she walks across the border and the next thing we see, she's back at her office. And then those other things are just hinted at.
Right. So let's talk about shows that weren't as successful. And the two that we were going to cover were When the Phone Rings and Captivating the King. So my unschooled opinion is that these two shows make mistakes in opposite directions. Because I think When the Phone Rings throws too many unnecessary plot twists, kind of to be sensational. And I think, on the other hand, Captivating the King didn't have enough tension or interest.
You know, I really enjoyed When the Phone Rings, but it did go to Argan, and I was confused as hell by Baek Sawan's motivations and actions. The acting, the music, and the chemistry were great, though, which is why, you know, I finished it. But you're right, the show didn't have the emotional heft of the other shows, and there's too many things going on. I mean, we had, what, 4 kidnappings? And then for Captivating the King, you and I had such high hopes for it because it had a beautiful premise, and Sung-hee, you and I love Jo Jung-suk. But then it went flat and ended up being kind of boring. So Ellen, what happened? We were so disappointed by Captivating the King.
Well, I think in When the Phone Rings, there were two major weaknesses. As we've mentioned before, Park Seon starts out being so cold and hostile to his wife, his secret wife, and then we eventually find out that he really loves her and wants to protect her, but it doesn't make any sense that he was acting so badly. And then he abandons her again.
Right.
Why?
Craziness.
And so that doesn't make any sense. And the foreshadowing and the payoff, that's where that comes in too, because we got no foreshadowing about the move to Argon. It seemed to me like they added an extra episode on to make the show longer or something. Or maybe they, during production, they cut out another whole storyline and decided to eliminate it. And so they added Argon on. But it just seemed ridiculous. So the combination of his understood motivation and the fact that we had no idea they were going to Argon or why, and we still to this day do not know.
Right. His motivation and his actions just did not add up at all.
Right.
No. No, and he's so cute, too. I mean, it was one of those, I can't believe I ate the whole thing at the end of the show. Because
oh, that's so true. I know. So tell us about Captivating the King. What did you think about the show?
In Captivating the King, I think there were three big issues. The first one is that there is no humor in it at all. It's just deadly serious the whole trip. Through the plot. And the female character, she keeps saying, "Yes, Your Majesty." I started to count how many times she said, "Yes, Your Majesty." So she had almost zero personality. I couldn't understand why he was so drawn to her, because she never talked, you know, because she was dressed as a man. She wasn't all that appealing from that standpoint. So that didn't make any sense. The other thing, she didn't look anything like a man. She was petite, had makeup on, and all these people are treating her like a guy as though they all believed she was a guy. And none of us believed she was a guy. The last thing is that they didn't trust the audience. They just put too many transition scenes in there where the king would say, "Please get someone to come and see me." Then we'd all travel to the place where the person was. Then we'd walk back with them. Then they'd be announced into the waiting room. And we could have skipped all that. As soon as he said he needed somebody, the next scene could be that person standing in front of him and having whatever it was that was talked about. And this went on and on again and again on the show. And my example is that Mr. Queen had many ceremonial, formal scenes in the royal context, and they never did that at all. We just went bam, bam, bam. So it never slowed down that way.
Well, you're absolutely right. When the king wanted someone, there were like three or four or five messengers who had to be involved. And it was like 10 minutes before the guy was in the presence of the king.
Yeah, that's a lifetime.
I know. I barely remember how Captivating the King got resolved. And I remember thinking, ooh, the king must be feeling really weird about these feelings he's having for a man when he's like a cis male. And I agree about the makeup. I mean, we've had lots of female actresses wear next to no makeup in a role. Like IU had very little makeup in My Mister. And Song Ji-an was so unglamorous in Silent Sea. And she is a gorgeous lady.
Well, you know, at this point, I have to say that Captivating the King has receded in my memory. I have to admit, I have little interest in revisiting it.
At this point, you don't even remember who's in it, Sung Hee.
Exactly. But I do have an issue with how gender disguise seems to be a plot point. I mean, like Joanna said, it must add a lot of complication in terms of how the king must be feeling. I mean, we're supposed to be very happy and relieved at the end when he discovers that she's actually a woman. But that whole thing just didn't resonate. It didn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Okay, so Ellen, you're saying that most shows at least follow the drama framework of setup, midpoint, and conclusion. But where they fall down is in things like character arcs, the foreshadowing, trusting the audience, humor breaks, pacing, etc. There's so many things that can go wrong in a show, and I guess that's why some shows call flat. But I want to talk a little bit about music, because you know that I'm a huge fan of the OSTs, and I believe that they contribute a lot to the success of a show. I adore the OST from Crash Landing, Mr. Sunshine, and Mr. Queen. I also actually like the OST from When the Phone Rings. I can't say that I found the Captivating the King OST particularly memorable, but talk to us about music. How does that play into all this?
Well, one of the simple examples that I like to use is the movie Casablanca, which most of us have seen. There's a single song, You Must Remember This, that is used throughout the movie, and it shifts into a major and a minor tone. That song tells us how to feel in that scene. And in the K-dramas, we'll have the same song repeated when things get romantic. I think you had an example from Extraordinary Attorney Woo. Every time she and her almost boyfriend are together and things get nice and sweet. But what I like about the K-dramas is they'll compose a whole bunch of songs just for the show. And they're beautiful, and they tell us how to feel in that moment.
You know, it seems to me that in U.S. dramas and movies that there might be just one or two standout songs. And one example I'll think of is I'll Always Love You with Whitney Houston in The Bodyguard. But other than that, it seems like the music is more like a backdrop or atmospheric. It's, to me, almost like more like a sophisticated sound effect rather than music that could stand on its own, like we see in the K-dramas.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? But we do know the power of music in movies. I mean, Star Wars would not be Star Wars without the amazing music of John Williams. And I just had a thought. How many movies, American movies, usually just have one or two songs, like you said? But think about K-pop Demon Hunters. The entire OST is so memorable. And I think four of the songs from the soundtrack made it to the top 10 of Billboard.
Right. But just think about like Extraordinary Attorney Woo. I mean, how many songs are on that OST? It's like 20 or 30?
No, more than that. It was more like 40.
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's a whole slate of songs. Whereas like in an American show, it's like one or two.
Yeah. Huh.
Well, Ellen, you have given us a lot to think about today, and now we have a different and much better and sophisticated language to talk about why a show works or doesn't work.
Ellen, you have so many thoughtful comments on the blog. I always appreciate it when you comment. Thank you for being on the show today. We're going to have you back because you're going to have to help us, like, you know, analyze why a specific show worked or didn't work. This was a real treat. Sung-hee and I and all of our listeners will never look at K-dramas the same way again.
Well, I hope I've helped because, as is often said, the plot has to thicken. And it has to thicken, just like with cooking a recipe, it has to have the right amount of flour and water and all of that to make it gel. And I hope that I've helped everybody not only appreciate why shows don't work, because they often don't. And you'll now start to notice things when you're watching things when they're not good. And maybe it'll help you bail out of a show when you can see that it's floundering, because you know you're not on a good road to anywhere good. But also, I want to emphasize that even when you know all of this stuff, it makes you appreciate it more.
Mm.
That's why we go back through episodes and rewatch shows when there's a rewatchability quotient in all of the shows. And these things that I've pointed out are the reasons why. We're not aware of them the first time we see them in the drama. But then when you go back and look, you go, oh, that was why. That was what was going on and all that. And it makes you appreciate it as an art form even more. So it's been my pleasure.
Well, Ellen, before we end our discussion, tell us, what are you watching?
Well, in anticipation of your someday doing Signal, I'm watching Signal.
And what do you think so far?
Oh my God, what a show. No wonder they're going to do a season two of it, which is another reason I think it would be fun to have it covered.
Oh my.
Oh.
Season two is coming out next year with the same cast and writer and crew and everything. I don't know how they're going to do that, but it was so popular that they've decided to do it.
Wow.
10 years jumping into the future. And I'm also trying to finish Bon Appetit, Your Majesty, before you guys let that cat out of the bag. I trust you guys so much. And so I'm sure if it was worth doing a whole show about, that it's pretty good. Malcolm recommended Will You Marry Me? And I haven't actually started that yet. I have Hulu, so I can go ahead and watch it. But that's on the list to start as soon as I finished Bon Appetit.
Well, ladies, I just finished Heavenly Ever After, and I loved it. The ending was completely unexpected and full of drama and tears and heart. And I'll tell you, there was so much chemistry between 42-year-old Son Suk-ho and 84-year-old Kim Hye-ja. This never would have worked as a U.S. show, but man, this Korean drama, absolutely loved it. I totally recommend it. Now, of course, I'm watching Signal with my husband and son, and I'm also watching Typhoon Family, but I'm still only halfway through the first episode. So there you have it.
Well, on the recommendation of Trip and Catch on the blog, I'm watching Because This Is Your First Life. And it is absolutely wonderful. The cast is amazing. It's an examination of dating, marriage, and the meaning of work and career. And I'm really enjoying it. I have to say, it's one of my favorite shows I've seen this year. Now, I've watched most of Typhoon Family, but I'm not sure if I'll keep going because I'm finding it a little bit predictable and repetitive.
Huh. Well, maybe I won't continue with Typhoon Family. Seven Seas said he gave up. I think Malcolm was like meh on it. So, I had high hopes for it. But you know what, Ellen? We're going to try and apply your framework and think about, was there good foreshadowing? You know, think about all the things that you say make something work, and maybe we'll have language to explain why Typhoon Family isn't quite doing it for us. Listeners, next week we're doing another in-between episode, and this time we're doing a single episode devoted to Bon Appetit, Your Majesty. We will be joined by the amazing Erna Belle DeMillo, who says that she wants to talk about amazing Korean food and the Michelin-starred restaurants in South Korea. And by the way, for the first time ever, there are Michelin-starred restaurants in the Philippines.
Wow.
This is the first time ever. So anyway, that's going to be a really fun episode. That's going to be next week.
Oh, I'm hungry already.
I know.
Well, Joanna, we promised our listeners that we would reveal the show that we will recap and analyze in season 13 of K-Drama Chat. So are you ready to reveal our choice?
Well, we have to be because we're at the end of what has been a truly heartwarming and enlightening season 12. The show that we will recap and analyze in season 13 of K-Drama Chat is Startup.
Ooh.
Woohoo. We considered so many shows. Thank you to everyone who recommended shows. And Sung-hee and I texted and talked and finally decided that we needed a show that wasn't too grim since we're going into the holiday season. We love this show. Plus, we haven't done a show about business, and it has a lovely romance.
Well, here's what ChatGPT has to say about Startup. Startup is a vibrant and emotionally charged Korean drama set in the fast-paced world of South Korea's startup scene. It follows a group of young entrepreneurs chasing big dreams in a fictional tech hub called Sandbox, where ambition, innovation, and love intersect. With a compelling blend of business struggles, personal growth, and a mysterious love letter from the past, Startup draws viewers into a story of resilience and second chances. So, that should be wonderful. Looking forward to it.
I love Startup. I've probably watched it 3 times. It has amazing acting, great business lessons, and a fabulous OST. And we get to talk about second lead syndrome. So listeners, you have 2 weeks to watch at least the first episode of Startup. Perhaps you've already watched the show. If so, watch along with us again. If you're new to Startup, feel free to watch ahead or watch along with us. Whatever style you prefer, we're looking forward to another great season. This is a great show.
I think Startup is magnificent. I watched it on Joanna's recommendation, and I can't think of a better show to suit the time of year that we're in. I especially appreciated it because of my career as a technical writer, because I'm a technical proposal writer. I've been through some of this stuff that they portray on the show, and it's fascinating.
Well, I just loved the actors, the characters, and the personal relationships in this story. So I'm really looking forward to revisiting it again.
I'm Joanna.
I'm Ellen.
And I'm Sung-hee.
This show was edited by John Uriarte, our wonderful audio engineer. Graphics were done by Alex Pineda, and the website is maintained by MJ Kato.
Don't forget to subscribe to the show, leave a 5-star rating, post a review in your favorite podcast site,
and comment on each episode on our website, kdramachat.com. If you're on social media, please follow and message us on Instagram at kdramachat. And if you like this podcast, please share it with your friends.
Bye.